Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. Bang, boom, bosh, or whatever they say. Here we are. So, Tony, fantastic to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here, Guy.
Well, I've really been looking forward to having a conversation with you. You have a book called Everyday Superhero that I do want to start talking to you about. But just before we get into that, I'd like just you to introduce yourself to the audience who don't know who you are, just so they have a sense of the role that you inhabit and your playground, so to speak.
Great. Well, I can't go into all my background, obviously, because I'm old, but born in Ireland, moved all around the world when I was a kid because my dad worked for the UN. Came back to Ireland when I was 14. My dad got a job in the Philippines and asked me, do you want to go to Christian Brothers boarding school or to high school in America? It took me about a nanosecond to decide. I went to high school in America, and from there I went to university, and then I met a girl. I was an engineer undergrad, so I did electrical engineering, worked in that field for about 18 months and realized, life can't just be about circuits and so on and so forth. And I started to notice these human beings floating around, and they were far more interesting and kind of confusing, if you will, than circuits. And so I went on and did graduate work in organization learning, organization psychology, anything to do with organization performance, basically, and ended up at IBM, worked there in the knowledge management group, which is what I originally focused on for my doctoral work. Then found myself in the whole world of e-business because my technical background came back when this thing called the internet was invented, Guy. You know, my kids don't know what I'm talking about, anything pre-internet. So then we started to understand how could you use the internet for business, so I was part of that group. But then I moved into IBM research because I always have this kind of academic side to me. I'm curious about why things work, and it takes a little bit more time to figure that out than the nanosecond they give you in the corporate world. And so I found myself at IBM research, which is a nice in-between. You know, they want you to focus on stuff that will eventually make money. That led me to do a big investigation into what's now being called the metaverse, but 3D virtual environments and so on and so forth. And at that time, the Fuqua School of Business, the dean of the Fuqua School of Business, his name was Blair Shepherd, was looking at trying to reinvent education and use new technologies and invited me to come work at Duke. And I've been there for the last 15 years. So I would classify myself as a pracademic. I like the academic world. I like to try to understand, you know, what the research says, particularly if it's non-obvious. I mean, that's why we do research, is, you know, the things that you think would happen don't happen, and we can back it up by science. And I think management is one of those places where we don't necessarily apply the research. We might know something to be true scientifically, but it doesn't get executed inside the organization. So that's kind of like where I like to sit.
And what is your actual role at Duke?
I'm a professor.
Is it of a particular discipline? Is that how it's sort of verbalized?
In the business school. So again, I guess I suppose, well, I would say I am not the finance operations, that kind of side of the business, the cost management side of the business. I teach in strategy, marketing, consulting, digital analytics, you know, data analytics.
Yep.
And global markets and institutions. So all of those are much broader, you know, macroeconomics, high-level strategy, marketing, you know, anything to do with kind of the psychology. I would also say anything that has to do with uncertainty. You know, if we know how to make a supply chain hum, or if we know how to work the analytics on kind of a telecom line or something like that, that's not what I'm into. I'm much more into the stuff we need to figure out together.
Okay. So let's get into the book, which has just got such a great title. I'm just going to hold it up here. Everyday Superhero. And I love that. How you can inspire everyone and create real change at work. Now, what anybody listening on the podcast cannot know is that when you open the book, it's would you I don't want to use the word cartoon. Would I say animated, or how would you describe what it is?
Well, Guy, you can definitely say cartoon. I suppose in the vernacular would be it's a graphic novel.
Graphic meaning, novel, that's much better.
Yeah.
So that really took me by surprise in the first instance, because there's no indicator that that's going to be the case. So just before we get into it, what made you choose that format?
Well, there's a story in that too, Guy. In that I was contracted by PMI, the Project Management Institute, to do research, to do more in-depth research of the literature, to try to understand one question: why is it that 70% of intended strategies, you know, a company says we want to whatever, introduce this new product, take this new market, make this acquisition, there's any number of things that a firm might choose to do, doesn't get realized? So the intention and the realization, there's a big gap. So 70% of the time, the intended strategy doesn't become realized, doesn't get executed. And PMI, Project Management Institute, is in the business of execution. They're in the business of getting things done. They're in the business of doing projects. And so this is a problem, right? If you're training professionals to kind of plan things on time, in budget, in scope, and get it done in the right cadence and rhythm to hit a particular time or budget target, and it's not happening, why is that? So I embarked on a couple of years of research trying to look at the literature very broadly, a very broad view of the academic literature, to try to understand what's the root cause. And what we found out was that the root cause is something called the tyranny of the tangible, that we tend to over-focus on structure or process or technology as a means to drive change.
I just missed that. It was what of the tangible?
The tyranny of the tangible.
The tyranny. Thank you.
Yeah. So, and the problem with that is we can grasp it. We can see it. We're implementing a new organization structure. We are implementing a new, whatever, Kanban process, MRP process, insert process here. We have a new technology that is going to, you know, double our efficiency or so on and so forth. So it's normally structure, process, technology. And therefore, we believe that we are, you know, in service of the new strategy, going to achieve it. And yet then 70% of the time, only 3 times out of 10 do we actually succeed. What does that mean? That means that companies are spending a huge amount of money to try to move themselves in a direction that they think will allow them to create more value, but they don't succeed in actually getting it done. And the reason for that is because organizations don't change unless people change. And people don't change unless they believe in the change, which means they have to understand the change. They have to find meaning in the change, right? So people won't behave differently unless they believe there's a good outcome. So the tyranny of the tangible is we over-focus on structure, process, technology, and we under-focus on humanity. The truth is that people don't resist change. That's why we're here and dinosaurs aren't. But people resist being changed. You will clean up your room this morning, was the phrase that I just used before I got on this podcast with my kid. Guess what? The room's not going to be cleaned up. Why? Because when he went into my room this morning to go brush his teeth, my room's a mess. So what motivation is there for him to change if I'm not demonstrating? So one of the things I talk about in the book is you have to have a subtle shift from demanding change behavior to demonstrating change behavior. You could go all the way to Gandhi there, you know, be the change you want to see in the world, right? But these are very subtle but significant shifts that you can make in your own leadership style that will then engender others to follow in that direction.
Yes, it's I think this is quite it's a huge sort of topic that sort of pushes itself everywhere. So I work with senior teams and when or leadership management development. And when I'm doing so, the model, the process for whatever it might be, giving somebody feedback, coaching somebody, any sort of process, is easy to educate somebody on. The intellectualization of it is not per se difficult. And if you're smart enough to be in the room, you're smart enough to get it. The big factor then is the motivation or the will to engage and change behavior. So this is really interesting. I do this thing actually where I get people to put their hands about 6 or 7 inches apart, clap their hands together, And you always do that with either your left or your right thumb on the top.
That's right.
Then when you swap them all over, it doesn't feel right because you've got a different thumb on the top. And actually, if you then get people to do that 10 or 15 times, when that's done, the room will have a response of, it doesn't feel any different, to it feels a little bit better, through to, oh, it feels all right now, which is just an immediate distribution curve of people's relationship to change. Intellectually, I know what you're asking me to do. It's my relationship with how I feel about it. So I think if I've heard you correctly, you're saying that the process and that kind of laser-like focus on the actions, that's almost a given, I think I'm hearing you there. You've got to be smart enough to organize it. How are you going to get people to engage? Is that what I've heard that correctly from you?
There's a fair amount in what you just said from a research perspective. What I tried to do, let me go back to you asked me how did it become a graphic novel. So I did all this research on change, and then I wrote up a typical academic report, 100 pages, 200 references, the whole nine yards, and I presented that at a conference, the Drucker Forum in Vienna. And I was approached by Random House. They said, I think you got a book here. And I said, hey, no problem. And essentially, I thought I could just take this academic report and turn it into a classic, 12-chapter business book, 190 pages, blah, 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 four graphics per chapter kind of thing. But as we got into it, Martina O'Sullivan, who's the editor, said, this is a book about people and change. You should make it a graphic novel. Huh. And I said, a graphic what? And she said, a cartoon. Back to what you were asking me earlier. A cartoon. So then I had to go off and I had to figure out this Joseph Campbell guy and what's the arc of a narrative. And then I figured out, every Hollywood movie follows this particular plot line. And then I had to try and conjure up a story, if you will, where May B, the main character, kind of encounters all of these challenges to change. You can think about Lewin and the forces of change, right? And then and tries to overcome it the traditional way, right? Using kind of the traditional command and control and tell people what to do and hold them accountable to outcomes and so on and so forth. And then she has a transformation. She has an epiphany where she goes more people-centered. Now to your question, so that's why we got to the graphic novel is we thought, the challenge was to try to get something that somebody could read in an hour to get the main essence of what the shifts would be. And then in the back of the book, I've got the links to all the research, if you're more interested. So on the one that you're particularly asking about now, there's a lot that goes on there. So you use the hands, right? I use folding your arms. It's the same thing. And you can have people do this for a while. But then if you go off for 1 minute and then you say, clasp your hands, or we tend to go back to what we originally did. You see what I'm saying? So we can train. It's habituation. We can train a little bit. And I know that you're a martial artist, right? You can train yourself and you can do that. But there is in our kind of biology a default setting, if you will.
Yes.
Right. And so the Adrian Slowatsky is the person I'd point to on this. He wrote a fantastic book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And basically the argument here is zebras don't think like you and I do. They're like running around on the Serengeti Plains and they see some grass. It's like, nice. And they start eating it. And then their sensory system notices something move. And then they realize it's a lion and then they run. Right. Now, as they're running, they're not like saying, is the lion going to get me? They're just running. And then all of a sudden they're like, I'm hungry. And then they go for the grass again. They're not living in fear of what might be or what they wish they hadn't done. We are, because we're human beings. And so we have, in one way, we can separate stimulus and response, which is great, right? Because we can then think about the future or examine the past and try to learn from the past. But at the same time, that stops us from kind of being in the present. It stops us from being cultivating the kind of relationships in the moment. And I think that this is becoming even more pernicious given the kind of rapid intrusion of technology into our lives. And so when you're talking about this notion of change and being aware, the new research suggests you should act your way into a new way of thinking. If you just try to think about and convince yourself, quitting smoking is not a cognitive activity. My mother goes, these things will kill me. She knows that they're not good for her. But there's a habit there that needs to be broken. And so you can't logically discuss this to try to convince someone, as you're talking about in your coaching work. It's like, try this for a day. Then try that for a day. Then try this for a day. And slowly over time, through micro shifts, we will, you know, move to whatever, becoming a black belt, giving up smoking, and so on and so forth.
I'm very interested in that because it happens to be that I do martial arts, but it could be any sure. sport, I guess, sport here. But so I find that if you don't know any different, then the new learning goes in very quickly.
Correct.
So if I do not know a certain technique and you show it to me, it's my only point of reference. Therefore, I adopt it immediately. Yeah. One could argue if I'm young talent and you show me that's the way, then it's the first thing I imprint on. But of course, if I've been doing it for a certain period of time, but what's interesting is I can know it for a certain period of time. And if I've never really found it satisfactory, then I'll also adopt it very easily, as in it never really worked for me. You're showing me the right way. The problem comes, I think, particularly with people in senior roles where, or people that have been in a role a long time and their survival mechanism for keeping their head down and just cracking on or whatever it might be, i.e., listen, I've seen senior people come with their strategies and you know what? They've gone and I'm still here. So I know one thing for sure. If I just get my work done, I won't get sacked. So why would I extend myself beyond what my workload is? So when people have mechanisms that have, in essence, been working for them, that's the tricky one.
You know, it's worse than that guy. Yeah. It's actually worse than that. So I'll go back to Adrian's work, right? The problem is biological. So go back to that zebra on the plains, yeah? So what happens there with the zebra is when it's eating and then it hears a noise or something, biologically, the blood moves away from the reproductive organs because I'm not going to be having sex anytime soon. And it goes into the heart and the legs because I might need to kind of push my body forward, right?
Yeah.
So the idea is blood moves to the parts of the body that move. That's the same for us. So we have the limbic brain, but then we have the prefrontal cortex, which is the thing that we have that most others don't, that allows us to kind of decision and discern and judge and so on and so forth.
Fast response, slow response kind of stuff, right?
Exactly. And so when we're placed into a position of fear, and fear is essentially when something happens that we're not familiar with, it's like then our kind of biological brain kicks in. And we go, what it's called, we go limbic. The blood literally flows from the front of the head. It's like we don't need to use that anymore. We just need to be prepared to run. And therefore, we fall into default. We only then execute on millennia of biological routines that were what has worked before. So this becomes a very, very tricky problem when it's, you know, there's a new sheriff in town. Are we going to change management? I always hated that name, change management, because if you don't know anything about the field, it means, oh, they're going to change management and I am management. Therefore, they're going to change me. Right. Yeah. Again, people don't resist change. They resist being changed. And so trick number one, not trick, but just reality number one is, you know, I'm from Ireland originally. And what we always say to each other when we meet each other is, what's the story? You know, catch me up on your story. What's the story? What's the story of change? So I don't know. Let's go to Martin Luther King. You know, he didn't show up that day and say, I have a plan. Because if he said, I had a plan, we wouldn't be talking about him now. He shared a dream and he kind of painted the picture of that dream, and other people could find themselves in that possible future. Therefore, their discretionary effort got unlocked and said, I believe that that could happen, so I'm going to behave differently and whatever, do the March on Selma. There's a whole number of things, but it begins with an aspiration. It begins with a narrative, and it needs to be a narrative, not a plan. The planning is absolutely critical. Don't get me wrong. There's a world full of fantastic narratives that never got executed. But it has to begin with a shared aspiration. If there's not a shared aspiration where people can find meaning in it, right, and believe that that's a future they want to co-create, then why would they get off the dime? They're going to sit in the basement and wait out that this echelon of management until the next one comes. We're predisposed. We're friendly with familiarity, and we're predisposed to the status quo. If we're left in our default status, the devil we know is better than the devil we don't. And therefore, we default to the status quo. And how do we break out of that cycle? It's not through dictation and mandates. You can do that to a certain point, right? There's different power bases inside organizations. The ones that we tend to think about a lot, French and Raven, the ones who originally did the research on this, is position power and coercion power. I'm your boss and I can kick your ass, right? Okay, so how long does that last, right? Basically, with each subsequent kick or order, right, without any kind of justification as to why, you're demotivating that person into essentially just being, you know, a waste of space in the organization. They're not contributing anything at all. And imagine an organization, Guy, where everybody in that organization did exactly what is said on their job description and nothing else. Today I'm doing bullet one on my job description, and then I'm going to do bullet two. Organizations run on discretionary effort, what people want to, not what they're told to.
So your
discretionary effort is, I mean, there's a whole bunch of research on this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. That's where meaning comes from. That's where it's the stuff you can't not do is probably a better way to say it. It's like, you know, for me, it's curiosity. If I can't figure out why something works, I'm going to, you know, this is why the internet's bad for me. I'm going to go figure it out. Why is the sky blue? Okay. Again, 3 hours later, I'm like, oh, now I know why the sky is blue. You see what I'm saying? If you can't, I think the discretionary effort is the biggest unlock potential in every organization. You walk around the organization, you just see a whole bunch of carbon-based life forms droning on through a series of processes and then moving from one structure to the next that they were told to. And it's almost inhuman. It's almost, to my way of thinking, it's a little bit like industrial agriculture with farm animals. Go back to animal farm. It's like we're just really pounding the creativity, ingenuity, passion, energy out of people and having them conform to structure, process, or technology. Because we believe that the tangible, hey, we're 70% done implementing software X, or we're 90% trained in process Y. We somehow assume that that's going to yield an outcome that makes a difference. But we know that it doesn't. But we have the research. That's why PMI came to me to ask, well, why the hell are we spending all this money? It's equivalent to the GDP of Brazil every year on stuff that ends up not adding any value and actually ends up frustrating people to the point where they're like, screw this, I'm out of here.
So this is not the difference between, but the balance between compliance and engagement then, really.
Yeah.
I can demand your compliance and all your energy can go into not being wrong. If I get your engagement, then one is looking for people then that will be compliant, as in they know what the compliance is, but then they're willing. And in that discretionary effort, you are talking about that willingness to go beyond, but you're also, and tell me what you think about this, you're willing to put yourself at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a psychological safety thing about, you know, if there are punishments, if the compliance is like an audit, if compliance is punishable, then there's no way I'm going to step outside of that hierarchy of needs of, well, first thing, protect thyself.
Yeah.
But also what we can't have is, you know, people running around the place, you know, thinking that, you know, it's a free for all. So there's a lot to do then here with that fear factor that exists as much as somebody on the bottom tier, as much as it does in somebody on the top tier, because the human response is the same regardless of the context that you're operating at.
100%. Mm. 100%. And actually, I believe, well, there's a whole bunch of stuff here that's, it's not necessarily, it's in the book, but not necessarily. It's another piece of research I did before this one.
Yeah.
I actually think that the most effective leadership is not top down or bottom up, it's middle out. And by that, what do I mean by that? We tended to say, hey, middle managers are the permafrost layer, they're the problem, they're the dinosaurs, get rid of them. I think that's completely false. I think that those that sit at the middle of an organization are the dynamos. Why? Because they sit between strategy and results. They are the conduit between what is it that we're aspiring to achieve and then are we actually going to achieve it. And to be quite honest, they're the ones that know sooner than anyone else whether the strategy will get executed or not. Now, there's an interesting thing in the word execution here, Guy. Execution means two things in the English language, to do or to kill, right? To do or to kill. So 70% of the time, strategies are killed. And the early signal detector is the middle manager. It's the leader in the middle of the organization who's going to know that well before the person in the mahogany office. So from a strategy to results perspective, the middle manager has the closest kind of spidey sense, if you want to call it that, from a superhero perspective. This is not going to happen. This is not going to work. But a lot of times they're not going to say it, because if they say it, then they're putting their head above the pulpit, and you know, if they're going to get their head mowed over, why say it? You know, I still want to send my kids to the university or something. The other place where middle managers sit is they sit between culture and people. They understand what kind of absorptive capacity the organization has for change, and they also know their people enough to be able to try to find alignment and meaning with those people and give them opportunities. So to me, the leading from the middle out, which is what May does in the second half of the book, is she applies what we call middle out leadership and people-centered leadership as opposed to top-down leadership. That's the big transformation I think we need to move to. Now, going back to what you talked about, we're literally, I don't know why, but in our conversation, which is very kind of extemporaneous, the first thing we talked about was you need a story, right? You need a narrative, compelling. So that's what I call communicate a compelling change narrative. You got to do that. The second is you have to act to think differently. If I want my kid to clean up his room, I need to clean up my room. So your behavior as a leader, your behavior speaks far more loudly than your words. If you demand change behavior, you might get some compliance. If you demonstrate change behavior, it's like, whoa, this person, you know, we hear it all the time, walk the talk, da 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 da. The third is embrace situational humility. Embracing situational humility, this is really hard because you're asking two things there. This is a two-way story. If you're going to be a leader and you're in a context that you don't understand, are you willing to show vulnerability over projecting power? Keep calm and carry on. I know what we're doing. Or, you know, I'm not sure what's going on here, but I am convinced that this team together can figure it out. And whatever you need from me, for us to do that, we're together. You see what I'm saying? So it's not like it's we're in this together, right? Or asking open questions over demanding definitive answers. Making failure safe over playing it safe. Because if you're always playing it safe, think about it, it doesn't stand to logic. If all you're going to do as an organization is play it safe, in academic terms, you're going to regress to a mean of mediocrity. You know, you, over time, that's just how math works. You will regress to a mean of mediocrity, and then you'll fall off the S&P 500, and everybody say, well, what happened to such and such a company? So there are points in which there are, you know, S-curves and inflection points that change in the environment or in technology or in strategy, and that's not a time for deductive reasoning. That's a time for abductive leaps of faith, and abductive leaps of faith require belief. You know, you have to see it to believe it, right? Or you have to believe it to see it. And we can go both ways on those things. So to make an abductive leap of faith, you need a shared narrative, right? You need to be willing to act differently. The micro-persuasion type of research, B.J. Fogg and those guys, Atomic Habits, James Clear, that kind of stuff. And then back into situational humility. You need to recognize that none of us is as smart as all of us. And whatever we can do collectively, where a different person, not in the hierarchy, might lead, at a particular point in time. General Marty Dempsey, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under the Obama administration, was around the corner at Duke after he left his post. And he said, leadership is stepping into the breach of uncertainty, right? Confident in your team's ability to deal with any eventuality. This is the guy running the biggest hierarchy on the planet, essentially saying, if you're fighting terrorists, it's a hierarchy versus a network. You have no idea what the outcome is going to be, but you have to have faith in your team. Therefore, you become a servant leader. And you relinquish power. And you give decision-making to the edge. His book, Radical Inclusion, talks about this quite a lot, right? So if the largest hierarchy on the planet is essentially recognizing that we need a shift in how we think about leadership and how leadership needs to move more towards the edge and how it needs to be managed from the middle out, why won't organizations do it? Here's the reason. I have worked through the hierarchy my whole life to get to the top of the heap, And my whole experience is informed by that. And so now that I'm facing fear, you work with leaders a lot. I mean, it's a very lonely and fearful place to be running an organization today. I think at least that's the experience I have in speaking with leaders, right?
Yeah.
Right? If you catch them in a vulnerable moment.
Yeah.
So what's happening then? The blood's going from their brain down and they're executing routines that worked in the 60s. The only problem is it's not the 60s. The world's changed.
Hmm. I think there's, I totally connect with everything that you're saying. I'm also quite fascinated, I think, by pace and the context that forces might be the wrong word, but takes people that are not disciplined enough or they're not emotionally in control of themselves enough to hold ground on what mm-hmm. they know to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And because I very rarely have anybody that would disagree with anything I would say on a workshop. And I couldn't imagine people listening to you. I mean, there might be debates on vocabulary, but they're not going to fundamentally disagree with you about what it is that you're saying. What I find the resistance is, no, I know you're right, but if you were operating in my context, the mm-hmm. application of what you're saying isn't practical because I'm trying to paint the car and service it while it's moving.
Mm-hmm.
So my pace is so great. The change is so great. As somebody said to me rather brilliantly, before the internet, I had to, you know, people had to wait for me to return to work before they could contact me. You know, mm-hmm. now it's, you know, all the things that we know to be true. So I think it's that great gap between the intellectualization of what good looks like, i.e., I know being fit's important, but if you saw my schedule, you'd realize when can I go to the gym?
Yeah.
You know, and yet there are people running multi-million pound organizations that are fit. You know, oh, I've got a child, I haven't got time for that. Well, I know an individual has got a couple of kids and she's training for a triathlon. It's the intellectualization of it for some people and the reality of shift, because I think they feel so overwhelmed by workload and pace and senior expectation that may not even be being ordered, i.e. can we see if we can get that done, goes from a general curiosity to a, they want that done, I must look valid, therefore I must do that quickly.
Yeah, so you're back into the same cycle, right? You're back into the self-preservation cycle. Now, there's a lot going on in what you just said, Guy, that actually is kind of above this, but I think maybe I could shed some light. So a lot of people talk about pace, or things are faster and faster, It's actually not that. If you look at the research, we have to use a little bit of physics here. So if you talk about distance between two points, the first derivative of that is distance over time, which is velocity. We call that speed, but velocity is speed in a direction. The next derivative of that is velocity over time, which is acceleration. So what we have is derivatives. In other words, it's not just a changing pace, it's actually changing derivatives. Now, what most people don't know is that the next derivative of acceleration is called jerk. And only people in space experience that. We talk about jerk, right? The next one after that is called snap.
Right.
The next one after that, I'm not kidding, is called crackle. And the next one after that is called pop.
Of course it is. Yes.
So what we actually literally have now is not just a things are getting faster. Like when we say that, what we mean, you know, in a physical sense is acceleration. What's actually literally happening right now is that technology is jerking humanity around. In other words, we're actually operating at jerk. I'm not going to say jerk speed. It's inaccurate to say jerk speed. But we're operating at a different level of change than we as human beings are instrumented to make sense of. Right? A zebra running around back in the Serengeti Plains, like we talked about, a zebra running around in the Serengeti Plains will... that they can process their context. Now, we're not instrumented. In fact, our biology runs counter. Our biology basically says, go limbic and kind of do what you used to do. When our environment, our context is operating at a level. It's not accelerating. I want to be clear. It's jerking. It's moving from. So it's not. This is what you know.
It's not a graduation.
Correct. It's a step change. Hmm. Right. So that's the first problem, is that it's not change, it's the rate of change itself is changing, right? So that's an exponential. And the second is, the more connected we become, the more complex our environment, so the more unpredictable it is. So you've got a y-axis of unpredictability, and you've got an x-axis of rate of change. The rate of change is compounding. It's like compound interest. And the degree of uncertainty is increasing. So what's happening is we're up in the top right-hand quadrant where we can't process at the rate at which we're required to, and we have no idea what's going to happen even if we could. And so you know, the human being doesn't get a new chip dropped into its head with twice the speed and 10 times the memory every year. I'm just getting a new laptop tomorrow. Yeah. Right, and my productivity is going to go way up because of my machine, not because of me. Right, my curve's going this way, their curve's going that way. But if you look at that at a kind of macro level, guys,
yes.
The system is putting a lot of stress on the human piece.
Well, there's a couple of beautiful things here. One is, I don't want snap, crackle, or pop, whatever. You know, that's
no,
for sure.
No, none of us want that.
But there is. I have spoken about the fact I saw it on a cartoon once, but you know, something like 60 or 70% of humanity is lactose intolerant. You know, we've domesticized the cow, but we haven't evolved to be able to deal with that. So it's almost in some respects, you know, there's this parallel I can see there between, you know, the everyday superstructure infrastructure of what we operate in is developing at this exponential rate, but we have not, because we're biological and we're not operating, you know, in the same context. We can't.
It's almost worse for us because we're biological and we have the capacity to think. So therefore, what happens is we can worry about a past or, oh shit, I wish I hadn't done that. And now I'm going to obsess about that. You know, I'm just going to dwell in the past, which is a complete exercise in futility. It's already happened. There's nothing you can do. Or I'm going to worry about the future. And if you're in the business of worrying about the future right now, you're going to be in a lot of trouble because, you know, existential risk and all the stuff that's going on, you know, you could literally be paralyzed. You could literally paralyze yourself and sit in a chair and become depressed. So what do you have to do? Compelling change narrative for what kind of future we want to see, act to think differently, and show vulnerability. Those are kind of the three core things that say, let's get humanity back on track to kind of reconfigure the world to be more human friendly and human centered. Then kind of, I really think that, you know, if you think about technology and where it's going, there's kind of four, I have four scenarios that I can talk about. This is a little bit more macro than the book, but I'm happy to chat about it. One is extinguished. I mean, obviously there's a lot going on right now, but I think it's important to be very, very clear about the fact that the unanticipated consequence of a whole series of actions right now, given the fact that we have developed weapon systems that can literally wipe us off the face of the earth, is a legitimate concern. So let's just be honest about that, and that's one. As somebody with kids, it's not something you want, but that's true. The second is enslaved. Enslaved is where essentially we are the creators of data. Right. And data is used. Right. There are systems, platforms out there that command our attention to control our consumption. That's the business model today of most of these platforms. Right. So essentially we're like indentured data servants working for server farm owners that monetize our bits into dollars. Yep. Right. So that's the enslaved piece. And a lot of times we're very happy to do it. It's convenient. Well, it's easy. We're TikToking our way through life.
I was going to say, I've just started up a TikTok account, and I'm very, I'm all over it. And I've noticed I'm on it all the time. Well,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Designed that way, guy. It's designed that way. And you could be happy, but are you? Who's serving whom? I guess would be the question to ask there.
Well, it can eat into your productivity. It can start to it feeds you information that reinforces your own ecosystem and all these factors, I guess,
right.
That
so
become very dangerous because it's not by choice, it's by what you're being offered.
Correct. Yeah, so you kind of get pulled exactly right. So the world conforms around your existing habits and behaviors, and then we can continue to feed you in that, which reinforces the status quo. But there's more there. The algorithms push you in a different direction, blah, blah,
blah. Yeah, yeah.
The next is enmeshed. My mother just got a knee replacement surgery. People get cochlear implants. It's not going to be too long now where we can kind of, you know, if you ever saw the film with the guy who takes the pill that makes him super smart. So like at some point in time, yeah, the Limitless, that's the one. Where, you know, if you know Ray Kurzweil or any of his research, the guy from Singularity who was at MIT, like we will, if Musk gets what he does with
Neuralink,
we'll have all of this opportunity to kind of not just enhance our knees or our ability to hear, but, you know, the glasses that are coming out now, I'm terrible with names, so great, every student's name will pop up. These are affordances, technological affordances that compensate for what we're weak in. That's great. But at what point are you giving up being human?
Well,
you see what I'm saying? That's so enmeshed. This is the whole this is the whole transhumanism kind of movement and all that. And the last one's empowered. The one that I think everybody should be focusing on that nobody is, which is what if we change the model from how do I control Tony's attention? How do I command Tony's attention to control his consumption? To how do I understand what makes Tony insanely curious and what he's really good at? And find him opportunities to exercise his curiosity and build his whatever, his mental muscle and his physical muscle. So how do I make the world a marketplace for Tony to become his best self? These are just two different algorithms. One algorithm is Tony is a source of data. Let me monitor Tony and let me squirt stuff at him so he will buy stuff. And another is Tony is a human being who has got amazing potential and just needs the right opportunity to show it. Let's surface 20 opportunities a day for Tony to become a better self. Well, the algorithm, the underlying algorithm is the same. The motivation is different, right? So to me, we don't need new technology. The technology is there. We just need new thinking. And the thinking needs to be more human-centered. That's all.
Well, this is really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, if we have a Neuralink, you know, if you said to me, Guy, would you like to have a mobile phone? We can do it now where we just put it into you, you know, we put it into your body, we connect it to your vocal cortex or whatever it is, and boff, you never need to. You can just dial, you know, verbally or whatever. I might go, yeah. But I've got a 9-year-old that would go, yeah.
Absolutely. If you watch Black Mirror, if you ever watch those shows, there's a show exactly about that.
Yeah. He'd take that on board in a heartbeat. Neuralink data on, you know, on a contact lens. Yeah, but now we can put it into your head. You just see it. Yep, he'd absorb. He'd take that on board in a heartbeat. So that, I guess, just like in an organization, because, you know, if we talk about the, you know, that kind of corporate versus, you know, culture. The reality is it's a microcosm of each other. And what is my intent? If my intent is you are a resource and I see you as nothing other than that, then even if what I'm doing may add value, the path, you know, I can't remember the guy's name now, but I think he was the CEO of Facebook that said, if I'd have understood what this was, I'd have never been involved with it, you know, because of what it is. But the intention isn't necessarily, and the integrity, that link between it. So this empowered, if we give you Neuralink, if we give you the capacity to access data, that's in itself a beautiful thing. But if we have an algorithm that feeds you confirmation about what it is that you all, and it doesn't give you challenge, it doesn't take you outside of yourself, it doesn't blah, 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 then actually we start to see what we're doing now, which is back in the day, I seem to remember when you and I would disagree on something, but we kind of meet in the mirror, in the middle, sorry. But now we're almost not allowed to have it, you know, if you do not sit on my side of the fence, you are fundamentally wrong. So we do see these things driving us apart. So that's very
interesting. The reason for that, Guy, the reason for that is emotion.
Yes.
Anger drives drives buying behavior, quite honestly. Fear and anger. Yes. So essentially the algorithms are kind of geared, if you will. I don't know if you know Tristan, but, you know, if you've watched The Social Dilemma, but I know Tristan. You know, this is psychology. This is like, you want to kind of raise emotions, and the negative emotions are the ones that probably work better, right? In terms of getting somebody to do something, right? inciting action. A lot of times in your own life, you can see it comes more from anger than, you know, meditating or whatever. And so, but again, this goes back to purpose. If you think about a company, right, and you just think about a company and how it measures value, right? If you look at the balance sheet, things like my computer is an asset, right? When I get my new computer from Duke tomorrow, it'll be listed there as an asset worth whatever, $5,000, blah, 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 blah. Where do people sit? People are a liability. People are a cost. So our whole accounting system, you know, tends to devalue the human, and the computer is valued more than the human in that system. And if we're having a down quarter and we need to make our balance sheet look better, we flush people because people are liabilities. So I think all the way back to how we even account for things is flawed. There was a movement back in the 90s with Baruch Lev at NYU where we really tried to kind of say we need to value things differently, right? And yet, if you look at this from a financial perspective, if Facebook disappeared tomorrow or Instagram and you were to have a yard sale, literally you take everything that, you know, all the desks, all the computers, the office space, the servers in the bottom room, whatever, you know, the stadium that they own or something like that, and you sold it, it'd be worth less than 10% of what the valuation of the firm is from a stock perspective. What's the difference? The difference is the belief in human potential and ingenuity to continue to create value. So in the short term, when we look at the books, we devalue the human. But in the long term, when we're looking at investing in a firm, what we're actually valuing is the human capital. And I hate that term, because I think if you reduce human to another form of capital, you got, you know, the intellectual capital, blah, blah, blah. Forget that. I don't think there should ever be a chief human capital officer. There should be a chief people officer. The primacy of people. Other things are capital. You know, even when we go back to original economics, there was, you know, resources and capital, and human resources were kind of, they were seen at that point in time as a factor of production. Muscle. It was brawn. It was muscle, not brains. Today, it's much more brains than brawn. But our accounting system doesn't keep up with that. And so if the system guy, I agree with you, organizations are nothing but people. So what I just said about people enmeshed in slaves, so on and so forth, is the same with an organization. What's the organization's purpose? To make money. That's what my students always say. I'm like, no, it's not. Money is an outcome, right? Would you work for whatever, a cigarette company? Would you work for whatever, a terrorist organization? They make a lot of money. No. Okay, now we get to purpose. What's your purpose? Then you get alignment around purpose. Then you give people autonomy to fulfill their purpose in alignment with your purpose. And you hold them accountable. But holding people accountable in this context, Guy, is different. If I'm a leader and I say, Guy, I know that you're into this and you're into that, and I think you should start a podcast and I will fund it, so on and so forth, blah, 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 blah. And it goes haywire, I'll cover you. So people who are in control in a hierarchy, the biggest problem is letting go of control. Accountability is, I'm going to give you autonomy, I believe, because you and I both have the same purpose and we're aligned around it, you'll do the right thing. And if it goes haywire, I'm not going to chop your head off because we're in this together. Right? That's a really, really hard thing for leaders to do. So two things that you mentioned earlier that I'd like to circle back around on. Unlearning is far harder than learning. Hmm. Right? So if you want to learn something new, like you just said, this is why it's easy for kids. They have more plasticity in their brains. They have no internal resistance to it because they haven't been burned before. They haven't this before. They haven't that before. So they just kind of absorb it in. As we get older and we've had some scars, then even in our subconscious, we may not even be conscious of it. We kind of hold off. We hold off from kind of, well, hold on. We may not even know why, but there's something in our head that goes, well, hold on. And then we let's wait and see. Not so sure. Like, yeah, just feeling queasy, you know, that kind of thing. Organizations are similar. Organizations are nothing but people. So if organizations are really there to maximize profitability and they see humans as cogs, cost of goods sold, cogs in a machine, then they'll look to automate you out of the business. They'll look to reduce variability, et cetera, et cetera. If, on the other hand, they look at humans as the raison d'etre for the firm, right, and that their ingenuity and discretionary effort will create the survivability of the firm, then they have to create the right conditions to allow everybody in the organization to become their fullest selves, right? And that's what we call, that's what, you know, the literature would call a deliberately developmental organization. How can you create an organization that is deliberately trying to allow every individual in that organization to follow their curiosity, become their best selves? To which somebody says, well, who's going to clean the toilet? To which I say, hey, you can go all the way back to Robert or JFK in NASA after he said, we're going to go to the moon. And he goes to visit NASA. And what happens? He meets the janitor. He says, what do you do? And he said, I help people go to space. Everybody has a role to play. And you know what? People need clean toilets. I'm happy to do that. Why? Because I'd rather clean toilets at NASA than whatever.
Well, it's been a meaning to my, to the
right meaning. Yeah. Meaning's the new money.
Yeah.
Meaning's the new money. Right. And so in the book I talk about, there's kind of four things. You need aspiration, alignment, autonomy, and accountability. You get those four things, you get an agile enterprise. You get an enterprise that moves with the vagaries of uncertainty and that can adapt to jerk. That's the essential idea.
So I'm going to put the links in the description for this episode. And I've said this now, I think about, I've done about 85 of podcast episodes. And I think I've said it 85 times, which is with a bottle of wine and the right food, I could go on all week.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I hold you to that when I come to England, guy.
Well, make me a port of call. Dinner's on me. That's for sure. I'm going to ask your question that's rhetorical, but I'd just like to hear you say it, which is, who's this for? Who's the book for, Tony?
It's for anyone in any kind of organization. That's the whole beauty of it. It's whether you work for an NGO, a government, a business, you know, a kid starting out, an entrepreneur. It's really about, you know, what are the 10 elements that allow you to create the kind of organization that respects humanity, right? And then what are the shifts, 30 shifts you need to make as a leadership system in order to allow that to not kind of atrophy and become, you know, the kind of organizations that we all hate to go work at. Honestly, it could be from the CEO to the janitor, as we were just talking about.
And where do I get this? Is it Amazon?
Yeah, it's, well, of course, everything's on Amazon these days, right? So it's on Amazon. It's in bookstores in England now. It'll be in bookstores in the United States.
Great. And I'll put the links in below. So listen, realizing I've got another 942 questions, but that would mean I need to sign up to one of your classes. Just on a personal note, I'll say all links in. I just want to say thank you very much for your time. I think it's a privilege to have you on. And I sense, you know, sometimes I speak to people and it's like pulling teeth. And I think, I know I seem to know more about this than you do. And that's really worrying because I don't know much about it. And then I speak to somebody such as yourself and I can feel you holding back on a dam of knowledge and information and selectively offering the things, you know, in the moment. So I appreciate that. And that means that means a lot to me when I experience that. So just from me to you and anybody listening, thank you so much for giving your time. Very much appreciated.
Pleasure, Guy. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it and love your questions.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness and changing culture. Oh, and of course you can buy my book Living Brave Leadership on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.